12646. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this.
A jury has found former police officer Derek Chauvin guilty of George Floyd's murder. This case has implications everywhere, including communities in Michigan looking for a way out of toxic policing culture. From Grand Rapids to Detroit, activists and community members have been in the streets to celebrate, the same streets they walked time and again during months of protests last summer. Let's hear from a few of them.
So today is certainly a victory for the movement in defense of black and brown lives. Unfortunately, it falls short of freedom.
This verdict means a lot. It means the world, but it's still not enough. Okay, he's found guilty. Now what? Now what? How much time is he going to do? What are you going to do to stop it in the future?
This is fantastic that the system finally acknowledged that. But there's a lot of families who hasn't had that acknowledgement yet. So it is up to us to keep that going.
Revolution.
You can't stop the revolution.
GRPD is not the solution.
GRPD.
It took all of that hard work and all of that effort to get this kind of verdict for one police officer. And that to me says that there's a lot more work to do.
I think that we are past level one, and that our organizing efforts are going to intensify because what we really want is transformative change for the entire system.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
We don't get it!
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We just heard the voices of Nakia Wallace of Detroit, Allie Bates of Grand Rapids, Danny Santiago of Grand Rapids, Alexandria Hughes of Dearborn, and Ray Lanier of Detroit. As you may have heard, many activists see this win as a starting point, not an ending. Now that the verdict is in, are we in a different chapter in America's conversation about police and use of force? We're going to talk this through with a couple of people who follow the legal and social forces in play. With us are Tracy Brahm, an associate dean at Western Michigan University's Cooley Law School. She also serves as director of the university's Innocence Project. Tracy, it's nice to have you back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're also speaking today with Jennifer Cobina, an associate professor at Michigan State University's School of Criminal Justice. Jennifer, it's a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This is not the first time that America has had access to a very immediate video image of Black death at the hands of police, but I wanted to ask both of you the extent to which it may have raised the stakes, if at all. Tracy, would you mind starting out?
Sure. And you're absolutely right, April. This is unfortunately, you know, not the first time that something like this has been broadcast. Did it raise the stakes? You know, absolutely. You and I spoke last summer about how much it would raise the stakes. And I think yesterday we saw a little bit of that, right? A glimpse into that. This was different, right? At least in the sense that it was not your split second police encounter. You know, did the person have a weapon? Was the suspect's hands up, et cetera? It was not just a video or visualization of the violence. It was 9.5 excruciating minutes where you could not only see what was happening to George Floyd, you could hear the pleas from the bystanders, you could hear pleas from Mr. Floyd himself, you know, all of which weren't heeded by the officers involved. And I think that really shocked the conscience, certainly of the people who witnessed it and of many in the country as well, and certainly many even in law enforcement. So I think in that sense, you know, the stakes were raised in this incident.
Jennifer, I wonder if you agree, and if the stakes are higher, what implications does this verdict have for us here in Michigan?
Certainly the stakes are higher. You know, I do want to say that, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement also has certainly played, I think, a huge role in really trying to push for a change and really bringing these issues to the consciousness of America. The movement has become the largest civil rights movement in U.S. history. Certainly, it has brought people of all racial, ethnic backgrounds together, gender, age, and even location, such that the protests, you know, we saw take place in not only in urban areas, but suburban and rural areas, in large cities and small towns. I think one of the reasons there's been so many so much protest is because of the backing of the organization of the Black Lives Matter, which we know was people who really pushed and put pressure on elected officials to spotlight these issues of inequities within the criminal legal system.
Another thing that was unusual about this case and this time is that Derek Chauvin's former employer went to some lengths to distance itself from him, painting him as one of a few bad apples. This is a case where we saw more than one police officer testifying for the prosecution. In the past, police officers have often walked away without being even indicted because of the court precedents holding that police have broad latitude if they believe they're in danger. Now, we can talk about qualified immunity in the minds of jurors, you know, looking at evidence and deciding whether an officer was justified. And we can talk about the broader legal precedents that have shaped how charges even get filed. I guess, Tracy, let's start with this. Did the testimony of Derek Chauvin's peers, do you think, tip the scale in this case?
You know, yes, that was one of the big differences in this case. You know, we hear about the blue wall, right? We hear about the reluctance of officers to testify against one another, to, you know, how investigations could be so closed and insular when officers are accused of misconduct. And you're right, Derek Chauvin's superiors and peers and other officers from other parts of the country distanced themselves from this. You heard very, very powerful testimony from within the department and without, just about how this wasn't policing, you know, and that's not always the case. You know, officers, even in some of the other cases that we're seeing arise now, unfortunately, you know, there are serious conversations about the reasonableness of the officer's actions. In this case, you were hard pressed to find someone who would, support the reasonableness, the argument that the actions in this case were reasonable. So I think you're right. They were trying to cast him as a bad apple, both, you know, to hopefully let the community know that not all police are like Derek Chauvin, but also, you know, to try to hold him accountable, right? To try to set a standard. You know, I think this case was just beyond the pale, you know, even for a law enforcement world in which, you know, they protect each other. So,
Jennifer, when we see multiple officers testifying as part of the prosecutor's case, Is it possible this is a case of the exception proving the rule?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question, because I know a lot of people, you know, are questioning whether or not real transformation will take place. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important for us to know that this, you know, really has been, it is the exception, right? So, you know, the relief and the celebration that you're seeing many people have is really tied to the absence of injustice, because, mm-hmm. you know, history has shown that, right, history has not always been on the side of people of color trying to get justice in this country. Specifically, fewer than 10 police officers have been convicted of murder in the past 15 years. You know, Derek Chauvin is the eighth officer convicted of murder in the past 15 years. And very few officers are ever found guilty of killing unarmed Black people. And I think it's also worth noting that I certainly agree with Dr. Brehm that we saw a lot of officers choose not to go to bat for Chauvin, but it took overwhelming evidence with unimaginable footage and witnesses to bring this case to trial and to gain convictions. And, you know, in many cases, there's not going to be such overwhelming evidence, right? And so I think we just need to make note of that, because the reality is so few officers are rarely held accountable. They're rarely indicted, rarely convicted. And this is certainly an exception to the rule. And therein really lies the problem.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll bring the conversation to Michigan as Tracy and Jennifer talk about transparency and accountability and the context of defunding policing. We'll be right back.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Support for the Stateside podcast comes from Kalamazoo College, offering a personalized education that combines critical thinking, curiosity, and creativity. Committed to preparing students for meaningful careers that make a positive impact on the world. More at kzoo.edu.
Jennifer, let's talk about pieces that might be missing from this conversation right now. What pieces of accountability tend to matter when you're talking about an investigation of this kind?
So, you know, in terms of accountability, the frustration that you see many people have had is that officers are rarely held accountable for their actions. And so, you know, we have seen a great deal of demand for example, ending qualified immunity, which is the legislation that prevents legitimate civil lawsuits from being heard when an officer violates constitutional rights. And so it's because of, you know, qualified immunity and strong police unions, it's often very difficult to hold police officers accountable. It's the reason why there's been such a push, for instance, from many activists to defund the police in terms of reallocating resources away from the police and invest in marginalized communities. Because research has shown that many do target poor Black and Brown communities, and where Black individuals are often viewed with suspicion as threatening and as criminals. And as a result, they end up being getting the short end of the stick in terms of becoming the recipient of aggressive police tactics.
Derek Chauvin was the subject of several complaints about use of force prior to last May. Tracy, is there anything that we should take away from this case about upstream warning signs for officers who do use force inappropriately?
Yeah, absolutely. I hope that is of the many reforms, right, that need to be considered in light of these incidents. I hope that is one that gains legs after this. This was the most severe incident involving Officer Chauvin, but it wasn't the only time that he's received the complaints or that the department received complaints about his methods, right, his methods of policing. And I'm hoping that departments will pay more attention to that. I know that, you know, here in Michigan, our governor has tried to take steps to hold accountable and to flag, right, in a better way, officers that have a track record, people involved in criminal justice system in general that have a track record of misconduct or unjust practices. And so hopefully, you know, again, that's something that we will, you know, think more and more about and that we'll pay attention to, and not just, you know, blow it off as a tough policing or a tough cop.
And part of that is also like creating this date, having a national database, right?
Exactly.
Where mm-hmm. officers who are, for example, terminated due to misconduct or who resign while under investigation, they need to be placed on a national database so they can't go from one jurisdiction to another.
Exactly.
To continue policing.
Exactly.
We've heard a number of different conversations, both in Minnesota and in Detroit and many other communities. I know Grand Rapids has had some conversation about this as well, about the degree to which police should be defunded, or to put it another way, the way that police funding can be restructured to A, meet community needs, and B, try to change systemic factors in how American policing is done right now. But there's been so much less energy behind it lately. Is there still a possibility that this is an avenue to explore?
You know, I would say so. And even though there hasn't been as much coverage in the media with this, I will say there are certainly a number of activists and protesters who are continuing to push for defund the police and put pressure on elected officials. You know, police funding encompasses about anywhere from 20 to 45% of many cities and municipalities' budgets. $100 billion is spent each year on policing and $80 billion on incarceration every single year. And there needs to be a call for service and clearance rate analysis that that's conducted to determine whether these resources that are allocated actually match the output, because in most cities, the analysis will show a low rate of return. That is, the vast majority of calls for services, you know, have nothing to do with violent crimes. And in most cases, the clearance rate for violent crime is quite abysmal. So for example, the FBI's Uniform Crime Report shows that about 40% of homicides go unsolved every single year. 66% of rapes go unsolved each year. 70% of robberies and 50% of aggravated assaults go unsolved every single year. And so, you know, police officers certainly have a series of responsibilities that they have to deal with on a daily basis, but some of these responsibilities can be reallocated to other social services, particularly mental health and addiction calls.
So I think Professor Kubina is absolutely right. And I think this issue is so nuanced, and that's why you might not, you know, kind of hear it as prevalently in the news, because it's a difficult question. And when people hear defund the police, right, from a rhetoric perspective, it sounds like, oh my goodness, people don't want police in their communities. They just want to totally abolish policing, right? And there may be some folks that feel that way, but in reality, what needs to be done is more nuanced, right? A more nuanced conversation like the one, you know, that Professor Kubina suggests, like really looking at where do the resources go that we give to police departments, right, that we put toward criminal justice, and how can they be better allocated? How can we better serve communities, right? How can we talk about what the relationship between the police and community should be, right, in a way that protects but also serves, which, you know, both of those things seem to be sometimes in short supplies. And so the conversation needs to be had. It's a nuanced one, though, and it's one that's important to continue to talk about so that it doesn't just become kind of a rhetorical question between defunding the police or keeping the police, because it's just not that simple, right? It's how do we police and how do we talk about the circumstances that led to that day, that to that confrontation between George Floyd and Derek Chauvin, right? There are all kinds of things that happened before from the police and in George Floyd's life, right? That we need to talk about and talk about how we can allocate resources to you know, keep those things from happening in the first place.
Yeah. Tracy, we've talked before about what reform even means in a country with literally thousands of different jurisdictions, many possible places where we can put change into action. And when we get to the local level, there's such a polarity in terms of how we talk about the problems. Earlier this hour, for example, we were speaking with Tristan Taylor of Detroit Will Breathe about the back and forth with the city over transparency and complaints about police. Mm-hmm. And we've heard mm-hmm. Chief Craig of Detroit speak out in recent days against members of Congress, including Representative Tlaib. This sort of binary is something that doesn't seem very conducive to a conversation or the kind of sweeping change that many are calling for. I wonder, do either of you have a sense of where the middle is or where the appropriate levels for intervention are in this moment? Tracy, would you like to start?
Well, yeah, that's a $64,000 question, right? And I think you're right. It varies so from location to location. I know I can speak here in Grand Rapids. You know, Eric Payne, our police chief, is trying to find that middle. You know, he's established the police and community advisory committee, you know, that asks for input from the community to tackle those exact questions, right? Like, where should we start? You know, how can we gain incremental reform that's meaningful, that has meaningful input from community? And maybe that's a good place to start. You know, I'm usually all about starting with conversation. You know, sometimes it's hard to move from conversation to action. I think Chief Payne is really trying to do that, but I think it has to start with the local level, you know, putting your finger on the pulse of the dynamics of the communities that are being affected and getting their input.
Jennifer, where do you start with this?
You know, I definitely agree. It's a huge question. You know, I think part of this, though, is trying to figure out how we can create systems of care and systems mm-hmm. of justice instead of systems of oppression and harm, mm-hmm. you know, and part of this is attempting to focus on addressing some of the root causes of crimes, trying to address the systems within policing that to ensure that there's not this warrior mentality that takes place, particularly in marginalized communities. And so, you know, I would say, you know, in order to ameliorate some of the conditions that give rise to high levels of crime, it is important for us to consider, you know, where else can we also consider addressing harm that takes place that is not just focused on law enforcement, and not just expecting law enforcement to address all of societal's problems, you know, because we do tend to look to the police to solve issues, for example, of abuse and abandonment, unemployment, homelessness, school disruption, domestic abuse, right? We look to the police to solve all of these issues, but I think it is important to create, think about and start looking. And there are some communities that have, some organizations that have already attempted to figure out ways to address harm and conflict within their communities without always relying on law enforcement.
Coming to us from Michigan State University School of Criminal Justice, Jennifer Kobina is an associate professor in the field. Tracy Brame has also been talking with us. She's an associate dean at Cooley Law School at Western Michigan University. Jennifer, Tracy, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Always. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And that's the Stateside Podcast. I'm April Baer. If you're ever looking for a little bit longer listen, you can find full Stateside shows for streaming at michiganradio.org. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Today's episode was produced by Aaron Allen. Our theme music is by 14KT with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.